November 7th, Lecture 12.
November 7th, Lecture 12 on Force. November 7th, Lecture 12 on Force. November 7th, Lecture 12 on Force. What?
You believe it now? Is it a magnet? Hi, I'm all chained down, ready to go.
We're going to have a show today, are we?
A little bit. I'm not much good at the show business, but we'll see what happens. None of my experiments really work.
But you know, some of the best demonstrations that have been given, one like by Zwicky, when things went wrong and Zwicky made such a fuss when they were going wrong, the boys remember them better than the things that just
now. Listen, I said I'd see you this afternoon at 2, but in the meantime, due to an error in memory, somebody called up from San Diego, from Palo Alto, and said they'd come down and see me. And I said, okay, Tuesday, at just the time I was going to see you. I've worked out this whole thing now. I got the whole plan for the next, this year, and partly for next year, which is what you want. How many more lectures are there in this particular 1A? You know?
I have to look at the calendar.
But there are altogether roughly how many lectures?
About 20 per term. 18 per term.
Well, I want to talk to you because I only got 15 made up. Today's lecture is on the characteristics of force. Not only is it interesting to study the physical laws for the interest that they have in understanding nature, but one must stop every once in a while and think, what does it really mean? Of course, the meaning of any sentence is a philosophical question that has bothered people from time immemorial. And the meaning of questions of physical laws are even more interesting because it's generally believed that they represent some kind of real knowledge. And the meaning of knowledge and so forth is a deep problem in philosophy. So it always is interesting to ask, what does it mean? Let's ask, what do the physical laws of Newton mean, in which we say F equals ma? What is the meaning of the mass? And well, we can intuitively feel that, and we define the acceleration if we know what the meaning of position and time is. Now, we won't discuss that. But the new concept, force, is the one that we want to concentrate on. Now, one could simply say, how do you define force? It's very simple. If a thing is accelerating, then there's a force on it, because that's what Newton's law says. And so the most precise and beautiful definition of force that you could imagine would be to say that force is defined to be the mass times the acceleration on an object. For example, if we make a law such that the conservation of momentum is valid, if all the external forces added together are zero, and then you want to know, well, what does that mean that all the external forces added together are zero? A pleasant way to define that would be, well, when the total momentum is a constant, then the external sum of the external forces is zero. Now, there must be something wrong with that, because it probably is just not saying anything. Because if we have discovered a fundamental law here, and we say that the force is equal to the mass times the acceleration, and then define the force to be the mass times the acceleration, we haven't found out anything. If you say an object without any force acting on it moves at a constant velocity in a straight line, if I observe an object not moving at a constant velocity in a straight line, then I will say there's a force on it. Now, this certainly can't be the content of physics. because it's a circular definition. It is, however, the most precise definition of force and one which appeals to the mathematician. On the other hand, it is completely useless because no prediction whatsoever can be made from a definition. You can sit in an armchair all day long and define as many words as you want. But then to find out what happens when two balls push against each other or you hang a spring, a weight on a spring and so on, is another matter altogether, because the way it behaves is something outside of your choice of definition. If you were to choose, for example, to say that an object left to itself keeps its position and doesn't move, and when I see something drifting, then that must be due to a gorse. A gorse is the rate of change of position. And I will, now I have a new law, and it's a wonderful law. Everything stands still except when a gorse is acting and when it's caught. You see, that would be analogous to this definition of force, and it would contain no information. The real content of Newton's laws is this, that the force is supposed to have some properties. In addition to that definition, it's not a definition, but the force should have independent properties. Now the feature is that the specific independent properties that the force have were not completely specified by Newton or by anybody else. And therefore, the physical law F equals ma is an incomplete law. It says, if you study the mass times the acceleration and call the other side the force, then as a program of interest, you'll find that if you study the characteristics of force, you'll find that they have a lot of simplicity. It's a good program to analyze nature. It's a suggestion that the forces will be simple. Now, the first example of such forces was the complete law of gravitation, which was given by Newton, and thus he answered the question, what is the force? If there were nothing but gravitation, then the combination of this law and the force law is, of course, a complete theory. But there is much more than gravitation, and we want to use Newton's laws for all kinds of things. And therefore, in order to proceed, we have to tell something about the properties of force. For example, the tacit assumption is made always that the force is not equal to zero, is equal to zero unless there's something around. That if you find the force is not equal to zero, you're going to find something doing it. There's something in the neighborhood. There's a source of the force. That's different than this case of the gorse that we were talking about before. So one of the most important characteristics is that force has an origin. And it's not just a definition. It's that got some other thing is making the force. Newton also gave a one rule about the force, that the force on the action on one object with the forces were equal and opposite, action equal reaction. But that, of course, turns out not to be exactly true. There are other things that he suggested that aren't exactly true. In fact, this isn't exactly true. You see, if it were a definition, we'd have to say it's always exactly true. But it's not. There's more to it. So in order to really understand Newton's laws, you have to have some idea about forces. Now you say, I don't like this imprecision. I would like to have everything defined exactly for me. In fact, I've learned in some books it says that science is an exact thing. Everything's defined. I'll let this guy get away with masses, and I'll let him get away with defining positions in time, because maybe Euclid took care of geometry. But I want a precise definition of force. You will never get it. First, because this law isn't exact. Second, because in order to understand physical laws, you must understand that they are all some kind of approximation of some kind. Take an object. What's an object who has a certain mass? Philosophers always say, what? Now, just take a chair, for example. The moment they do that, you know that they don't know what they're talking about anymore. What is a chair? The atoms are evaporating from it. From time to time, dirt falls on it and gets dissolved in the paint. I mean, just a few atoms, but to define the chair precisely, to say exactly which atoms are chair and which atoms are air, or which atoms are chair and which atoms are dirt and which atoms are paint that belongs to the chair and so on, is impossible. So that any simple idea is approximate. And in the same way, to define the mass of a single object is impossible because there aren't any single left alone objects in the world. It's all a mixture of lots of things. So we have all together in this thing a series of approximations and idealizations. The trick is the idealizations. In an excellent approximation to 1 part in 10 to the 23rd, the number of atoms is staying put in the chair. so that we can hold it for a minute if we're not too precise. And in the same way, we'll learn about the characteristics of force as long as we're not too precise in an ideal fashion. You may be dissatisfied with the approximate view of nature that physics tries to get at. The attempt is to ever increase the accuracy of the approximations. Because if you say, I would prefer a mathematical definition, you'll see a mathematical definition can never work. A mathematical definition will be good for mathematics in which all the logic can be followed out completely. But the physical world is complex, as I tried to explain in a number of examples, such as the ocean waves and a glass of wine. In order to isolate pieces of it, to talk about one mass, what, the wine, the glass, which is which, when one dissolves in the other, or the forces on a piece, on a single thing, already involve approximations. And if we have a system of discourse about the real world, then that system, at least at the present day, must involve approximations of some kind. Unlike the case of mathematics, in which everything can be defined, and then you don't know what you're talking about. In fact, the glory of mathematics is that you don't know what you're talking about. The glory is that the laws, the arguments, and the logic are independent of what it is. If you have any other set of objects which obeys the same system of axioms as Euclid's geometry, then the consequences, the circles are redefined as something else, and so on, and then all the consequences are correct. The logic is correct. And it doesn't make any difference what the subject was. But the question is whether in nature that when I draw a line or when I use a light beam with a, how do you call those, this, theodolites or something, if you use one of those things to do surveying, are you measuring a real, a line in the sense of Newton, of Euclid? That's an approximate idea. The crosshair has some width and it can't have no width. And so the Euclidean, whether Euclidean geometry can be used for surveying or not, that's a physical question. That's not a mathematical question. But from a scientific standpoint, not a mathematical standpoint, that is an experimental standpoint, we need to know whether the laws of Euclid apply to the geometry that we use in measuring land. And so we make an hypothesis that it does. And it works pretty well. In the same way, but it's not precise. You see, it does more or less, because none of our lines are really lines. But whether or not those lines of Euclid, which are abstract, apply to the lines of experience, that's a question for experience, and it's not a question that can be answered by sheer reason. And in the same way, we can't just get along, call this a definition, deduce everything purely mathematical, and make mechanics a mathematical theory, when mechanics is a description of nature. We can always make a mathematics, just like you can make a mathematics of Euclid. But you can't make a mathematics of the world, because sooner or later you've got to find out whether the axioms apply to the objects. And the moment you do that, you have these dirty objects. And if you want to talk about nature, you're going to talk about something complicated and dirty, and therefore, at first approximations, ever increasing in accuracy. Therefore, a true understanding of Newton's laws requires a discussion of forces. And therefore, this lecture is really a kind of completion of the Newton's laws. We study the definitions of accelerations and so on, but we have to study the properties of force. And now this lecture will be unlike the other lectures. It's not going to be very precise because forces are quite complicated. So let me begin with a force. Let's take the drag on an airplane flying through the air. So what's the law of that force? We have the law for every force. We have to have a law. Well, you don't think there'll be a simple law for that force. If you imagine what makes the drag on the airplane flying through the air rushing over the wings, the swirling in the back, and the changing going around the body of the thing and all these complications, well, you see that there's not going to be a simple law. On the other hand, it's really remarkable that the drag force on an airplane is approximately a constant times the cube of the velocity. Now, what is the status of such a law? Is that analogous to this? Not at all. Because in the first place, this is an empirical thing that's obtained roughly by testing a wind tunnel. You say, well, this might be empirical too. That's not the reason that there's a difference. The difference is not that it's empirical. The difference is this, that as we understand nature, this is the result of an enormous complexity of events and is not fundamentally a simple thing. If we continue to study it more and more, measuring it more and more accurately, it will continue to become more complicated, not less. In other words, as we study it more, this law, the drag on an airplane, better, more and more closely, we find out that it's falser and falser. And in the more accurately you measure it and the more accurately you study it, the more complicated the truth becomes. So in that sense, we consider it not a fundamental process. And of course, we understand why in this example, because of all the winds that's blowing around the airplane. It's such a complicated mess. For example, if the velocity is extremely low, so low that an ordinary airplane isn't flying, but if you drag it slowly through the air, then the law changes. Its velocity function depends more like velocity at very low speed. To take another example, the friction of a ball or a bubble or anything in honey, when you're pushing it through thick honey, is proportional to the velocity. But when you get going very fast so that the honey can swirls around some, which honey doesn't, but water and air does, then it gets more like the velocity cubed. And if you go up in velocity, this law begins to fail. People say, well, the coefficient changes slightly. Second, there are great complications. Can this force on the airplane be divided into the force on the wing, the force, this is a picture of an air, I can't draw. That's an airplane. Can this be analyzed as a force on the wings, a force on the front, and so on? Well, you can if you want to. If you need to worry about the torques here, then you got to get special laws for the force on the wings and so on. But the miracle of the thing is that the force on a wing depends upon the other wing. In other words, if you took the wing, the whole airplane apart and put just the wing in the air, then the force is not the same as if the plane is here. Reason, of course, is that the wind that hits the front goes around the wing and changes the force on the wing and so on. In other words, it's an ungodly mess. And in fact, it's a miracle that there's such a simple, rough, empirical law that can be used for the design of airplanes. But it is not in the same class as the other laws of physics, and a further study of it will only make it more and more complicated. A study of how this coefficient depends upon the shape of the front will make you absolutely crazy. There's no simple law for determining the coefficient in terms of the shape of the airplane. So a law like the law of gravitation is simple, and further study of it only indicates its greater simplicity. But a law like this does not. Well, we've taken two cases of friction, fast movement in the air, slow movement in honey. There's another kind of friction called dry friction. That's when you slide a block on another block. And here, there's a force needed to drag it along called the frictional force. Its origin is, again, a very complicated business. There are points of the bottom of this is irregular on an atomic level. And there are various points of contact. And the atoms sort of stick together. And then as you pull it along, they snap apart and shake. Boom. Something like that has to happen. People used to think that it was very simple. It was just that it was irregular, and the other bumps were irregular. And all you had to do is to lift it over the bumps. But if you think about that a while, you see that won't work because there's no loss of energy in that process, and you can't figure out where the power went which dragged the thing forward. The answer is that as it snaps over the bumps, the bumps bloop, and then generate waves and motions and heat after a while in the two body. Now, that's very remarkable again that empirically this friction has approximate simple law, so it says in the books. And the law of friction is this, that the force needed to drag something, which I'll call the frictional force, you know the direction of it, you don't have to worry about that. It depends upon the pressure or normal force between the two surfaces which are being dragged. And in fact, it turns out to a pretty good approximation under certain circumstances, the frictional force is proportional to the normal component of the force with a more or less constant coefficient. More careful studies show that this coefficient isn't exactly constant, but it's a good empirical rule for judging more or less the amount of force that you'll need under certain engineering circumstances. If the normal force gets too big, it fails, because if you push too hard, the whole block just squashes down into a molten mess. But it's important to realize that any one of these laws has its limitations, so that this doesn't really work. But I like to show you that it's approximately right and by a little experiment. If I have an inclined plane and have an object on it, then the component of force, the weight is this way. So the component of force in this direction, which would have to match the friction when it just begins to slide, has something to do with the angle here times the weight. And the normal component of force has something the opposite of it. The one is the sine and the other is the cosine of the angle. So you see that the ratio of the frictional force to the normal force is the tangent of the slope. At any rate, by increasing the slope, I can increase the friction force relative to the normal force. If this law were exactly true, therefore, an object would start to slide at a given inclination. If I increased the weight here by putting something else on top, I would increase the size of this, which would increase the frictional drag for the thing that's balancing the frictional force, but would also increase all in the same proportion of normal force. And if mu stayed constant, therefore, the thing would slide again at the same slope. So I'll try to show you how things really slide and whether or not they slide more or less at the same slope. And we'll take a very enormous difference in the mass of the thing. Here it's just going to be a light box, which is supposed to slide in this slot. And I find the angle at which it just begins to slide by holding this thing up higher and higher. And you see it sort of slides and stops. Why does it slide and stop? Because the coefficient of friction is not really a constant. It varies along the rod a little bit because there's fingerprints, dirt, and so on. But anyway, at something like this angle is the place where it begins to go. Now I do the same experiment with a weight inside to change the normal force and everything, a right considerable change, to see whether the angle is roughly the same. You see it just begins to slide a little like it did, and in order to get it to slide much, I have to come up, and it starts to slide with the same kind of irregularities, very much the same as it did with the very different mass, so that the mu is roughly constant. But we notice some things. First, that the mu, although it's supposed to depend upon only the two metals which rub against each other, two surfaces which rub against each other. In fact, there are tables, believe it or not, of the value of mu for copper on copper, steel on copper, and so on. They're all false. You can't get the same answers as in any table, because what the thing really depends upon is a layer of oxides and other dirt that's on the surfaces between the two materials. Because what's really rubbing against each other are the oxide coatings or any kind of oil, fingerprints, grease, etc., that happen to be there. So that the friction is never copper on copper or iron on copper, but copper oxide plus 62% oil residues against iron oxide plus a little bit of carbon that has come out of the steel, and so on. And every time it comes out differently. It's also quite difficult to do experiments in friction. And it's surprising how, in spite of its enormous engineering value, the laws of friction are still not analyzed very well. In particular, the reason for this phenomenon, that the friction is proportional to the normal force, which is really quite fairly accurate once you've got the surfaces standardized, is not really understood. And it also turns out that the coefficient of friction is nearly independent of velocity. But in order to demonstrate that requires some delicate experimentation. Because if this bottom thing vibrates very fast, the apparent friction is much reduced. Maybe you can figure out why. At any rate, that's true. And when you try to do the experiment at very high speed, you have to be careful that the objects are not vibrating relative to one another when you have all the equipment moving at high speed. So that apparent decreases of the friction at high speed are often due to vibrations. At any rate, this again is one of those semi-empirical laws which are not thoroughly understood, and I'm surprised that more work hasn't been done. Well, that's not fair. A lot of work has been done, but that more understanding hasn't come of this phenomenon. This is, in fact, one of the things that we still do not know how to even estimate. It's impossible to estimate the coefficient of friction between two substances at the present time. But I would like to point out this, that if you try to get absolutely pure substances, if you take, for example, copper and copper, and measure the coefficient, I don't know, 0.2, 0.4, depends on the oil, on the grease, and everything else. Then you clean the copper off, and you outgas it in a vacuum. You get it absolutely perfect, so it's absolutely pure copper, shining in copper, and there's no other elements around, and it's in a vacuum, it's been purified, and you put the slider on, turn it up like this, like that, it won't even fall off. The coefficient sort of gets kind of infinite, or at least several times one, so that it won't even slide when it's held up this way. The reason is that the moment that you have the atoms absolutely the same as one another, of a substance which holds itself together. What's going to stop the few atoms of copper from knowing, and how do they know that they're on a different piece of copper? And so it sticks together. And but there's, you see, other atoms like oxides and greases and so on, then there's more complicated layers in between, and the things know that they're not the same part, if I may say it that way. Anyway, it's not copper held on to copper like in the inside of a copper block. So it's impossible to get the right coefficient of friction for the pure metals. To show this at home, you can try this. Take like a glass plate and a glass tumbler and slide one on the other. Even a porcelain plate, I think, will work. And you find they slide pretty well. You can feel a coefficient of friction, a little irregular, but a coefficient of friction. Now wet the bottom and wet the plate, and you find that it binds. And if you had a glass plate and looked very closely, you find scratches. Because the water, in the case of glass, water is able to lift all the grease and all the other materials off the surface. And then we really have a glass-to-glass contact. And then it's so good that it holds. And when you go to pull it, it tears the glass apart. It would rather break some of the other pieces of glass than at the contact. So you can get scratches easily if you have it wet. This brings us to the question of molecular forces, the forces between the atoms, which is, of course, the ultimate origin of the friction. What are the characteristics of molecular forces? Well, they had never had an explanation on a classical physical basis, but it takes quantum mechanics to fully understand them. However, empirically, the laws of force between the atoms run something like this. If I plot the force between two atoms or molecules or something, no. If I plot the force between two molecules at a function of the distance between them, then you get something like this under certain circumstances. I'll define it in a minute. I'll define it now. There are different kinds of cases. Sometimes in a molecule like water, the negative charges sit more on the oxygen and the positives more on the hydrogen, so that the center of the mean position of the negative charge and the mean position of the positive charge are not at the same point. As a consequence of that, another molecule nearby finds a relatively large force, which is called a dipole-dipole force. But for many systems, the charges are very much better balanced. In particular, for an oxygen gas, for example, which is perfectly symmetrical, although there may be minus charges here and plus charges here, for example, I don't know where they lay out, the center of the minus charges and the center of the plus charges are on top of each other. A molecule where they're not is called a polar molecule, and this is called a dipole moment, the separation. While a molecule for which the charges coincide is called a nonpolar molecule. Now, for nonpolar molecules, which the forces are all neutralized, the electrical forces, it nevertheless turns out that for all of them, the force at very large distances varies inversely as the seventh power of the distance, times a constant that depends on the molecules. When there are dipoles, the forces are greater. Why this is, we'll only learn when we learn quantum mechanics. Then, at very short distances, the force varies inversely as the seventh power, so it's a attraction. This is the force of attraction. That's the way I make the sign, and then it's rising like this. But when it gets too close, they repel with a very large repulsion. That is, if you take two molecules and try to stick them together, they repel. That's what keeps me from falling through the floor. These molecular forces can be demonstrated in many ways, in a kind of direct way. One of them was this friction experiment. Another is to take the very carefully ground and lapped surfaces that are very accurately flat so that you can get the two substances together close enough, like the Johansson blocks, which are used in machine shop for making accurate measurements. And if you slide the two blocks over each other very carefully and hold one up, the other will stay up. From the molecular force, the direct attraction between the atoms on the one block for the atoms on the other block. Nevertheless, these forces of attraction are still not fundamental. They are due to a great complexity of the interactions of all the electrons and nuclei in one molecule with all the electrons and nuclei in another. It's a complicated thing. So we still haven't got to the fundamental phenomena. Oh, excuse me, before I get to that point, I'd like to mention another feature of the molecular forces. Because they attract at short at large distances and repel at short, then we can make up solids, which are held together, all the atoms are held together by their attractions and held apart by the repulsion that sets in when they're too close together. Now, at a certain distance, the forces are zero. That means they're all balanced. So they stay at that distance apart from one another, as indicated here. Now, if I were to squeeze them together so that they were forced to be closer together by just pushing, then they will all show, if they're closer together, a repulsion somewhere here. And so as then I squeeze harder and harder, the repulsion gets bigger and bigger in a complicated way. If I slightly pull them apart, then because they're a little further apart, there's a little bit of attraction. If I pull too hard, some of them will pull apart. They'll jump over here somehow and get away, and the thing will break in half. But if I push only a little distance and pull only a little distance, then I'm only moving a little distance on this curve. And for a little distance on this curve, I can approximate it with a straight line. So under many circumstances, if you don't push and pull by too big a distance, then the forces are proportional to how much you push. That means it's a straight line. That is, if you double the displacement away from here, you double the push, you get twice as much force. And this is known as Hooke's law, the law of elasticity, which says that the force that a body wishes to restore itself to its original shape when distorted is proportional to the distortion. It's only true, of course, if the distortion is relatively small. When it gets too big, you tear the object in pieces if you're pulling, or if you're squashing, you just go bleh. So you don't want to have too big a force. And the amount of force that you need depends upon the material. For instance, for dough and for putty, very small forces are required before Hooke's law doesn't work. For steel, relatively large forces are required. I have here an example to demonstrate Hooke's law. Ordinarily, you're only allowed to displace a little bit. But someone has invented a thing called a spring, which is a very clever way of arranging the steel so that making a very big apparent displacement is only a very small real effect on the steel. It's a twisting, a very tiny twisting on each one of those turns. It's all accumulated with a big deflection. So I put 100 grams, a certain force on here, and the thing is deflected a certain amount, which comes out to be 38.5 centimeters. Then if I put twice as many on, twice as much weight on, then it deflects an amount, which turns out to be 75.5 or 76 centimeters. So it isn't exactly right. The spring is getting a little stiffer than it should. It's not quite twice. Twice would have been 77. It's only 76. As you pull the spring too far, then the angles begin to change and the stiffness goes up a little bit. But for a good approximation, for not too big a deflection, the forces are proportional to the displacements, and that's Hooke's law. Well, those are the forces of, I lost my note. Thank you. Those are the forces of that kind. Now, the other forces that I'm now going to talk about are fundamental forces in the sense that their laws are fundamentally simple. And the only ones left that we know that are simple. And the one is electrical force. So we discuss electrical force first. Objects carry charges, which is simply the number of electrons or protons, or if they're fundamental particles, they can also carry their own charges. And objects which have charges, as you know, have an electric, I'm not fooling that you never heard this before, that there's a force between two charges. If I measure the charges of the electric charges of two objects and call them Q1 and Q2, then there's a force between two charges which varies inversely as the square of the distance, and there's a repulsion for like charges. It's like gravity, only the sign is reversed. It's a repulsion for like charges. Charges can either be plus or minus. And so the force between the two is directed along the line and is given by this law times some constant. Now, this constant depends upon, of course, what units you use for the charge. And for a long and complicated historical reasons, the charge is measured in a certain unit called a coulomb. And under those particular units, in order to get the force to come out in newtons and so on, there's a certain constant. And this constant, for equally obscure historical reasons, is written 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. And the numerical value of 4 pi epsilon naught, which is needed here, or 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, is what? In what? In meters and so on?
Yeah.
Okay, 8.85 times 10 to the minus 11 coulombs square, meters square per unit force, a newton or something. At any rate, that's the unit, that's the constant that belongs in here. Of course, in nature, the most important charge of all is the charge on an electron, so it's good to know how strong that is. And the charge on a single electron is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs. In fact, that's 1.60 to the next decimal place, coulombs. It turns out that many people in working with electrical forces between fundamental particles rather than big lumps of charge like to multiply this combination, the charge on an electron times the charge on the electron divided by 4 pi epsilon naught, is of course a little bit useful sometimes to simplify the equation. Anyway, this combination comes up all the time. And it has been given another name. It's called E square. And in this system of units, it turns out to be 4.80 times 10 to the minus 20 squared. Is it 20 or 10? 10. So that's also handy. That saves you the trouble of squaring this and dividing by that every time. But that's the way the units are. See, the advantage of this one is that then the force can be written E squared over R squared. You don't need all the constants. But it's not important. It's just a different ways of measuring, naming the same thing. But electrical forces are much more complicated. Although this is the electrical force between two objects, we'll find that that's only when the objects are standing still. I'll talk about magnetic forces in a moment, in a little few moments. But before I do that, I want to talk about the only other known forces, which are called nuclear forces. And I would like to write down a law for nuclear forces, but I've never seen it. Although there's a lot of talk about nuclear forces, nobody ever calculates the force between two nuclei. I don't think anybody ever writes down the formula for the force. Why? Because the force has a very tiny range. It's just about the size of a nucleus, maybe 10 to the minus 13 centimeters inside the nucleus. So what? So what is this? That when you're working in dimensions so small and particles so fine, the quantum mechanical laws are valid, not the Newtonian laws. So there's never a circumstance in which you want to use Newton's laws on nuclear particles at such a tiny distance, so that you don't have it in the form of forces anymore. In fact, and replace that with a concept of the energy of interaction of two particles, a subject we can discuss later. So we never write the formula for nuclear forces, but if we did write the formula for nuclear forces, you would find that it was more or less, very crudely, just leaving out an awful lot of complications, something like this. Inversely is a square, but dying off, like exponential, where this is, well, R over a certain distance, where this distance is about 10 to the minus 13 centimeters. In other words, the nuclear forces disappear as soon as the things are any distance apart, although they're very, very strong when they're within that range. In fact, today, the laws of nuclear force are not simple. We don't know them in a simple way, and the whole problem of analyzing the fundamental machinery behind nuclear forces is unsolved, and that has led us into discovering all the strange particles, pi mesons and whatnot, but we still haven't resolved the origin of these forces and nuclear forces. Now, in analyzing forces of more fundamental kinds, not forces like friction, but the electrical force or the gravitational force, a very interesting and a very important concept has been developed, because it turns out that the forces are much more complicated than this at first sight law. It's only true when they're standing still. And when they start to move in a complicated way, the forces are very complicated. And it's turned out that a method of analysis of forces of great utility is this. It's a concept called the concept of a field. And the idea is the following. If we have, for instance, electrical force or gravitational force, we have a charge here, and we put a little charge here, another charge here, there's a force between them, proportional this way. Now, the way we're going to analyze that force is to say this, that before we put this charge here, we're going to analyze this way. This produces something over here, so that when the charge is put there, it feels the force. Funny way of describing it, but a way. We say it this way, that the force that we've written over here can be written in two parts. It's Q2 times a quantity which would be there whether this charge is here or not, provided I keep all the other ones in their right places. This is the stuff made by this, we say, and this is the response of this to that. This is called the field. Of course, it's vectors. Then the formula for the electric field, of course, is that it's produced by a charge, is that the charge times this crazy unit, the crazy constant over r squared, and directed in the direction of the radius vector, which, if you know vectors, is the radius vector over its own length. So there's the electric force. This is the field, and this is the charge times the field. And what's the point of this? The point of this is to divide the analysis into two parts. One is to say something makes the field, and then this acts in the field. It separates the analysis of the problem. It means that in many situations, we can calculate the problem in two parts. We first work out the total electric field produced by all the charges, and then knowing the properties of this charge that we're putting in here, we find the force on it. It divides the problem into A makes the field and B feels the field. In the case of gravitation, for example, we can do exactly the same thing. In the case of gravitation, where the force is equal to the product of the masses times a gravitational constant over r squared, we can make an analysis like this. The force on an object in a gravitational field is the mass of that object times the field, which I'll call C. The force is the mass of the object times the field produced by the other objects. Then the field produced by an object of mass m is gm over r squared and is directed radially. Same idea. You say that's a trivial nonsense. That's mere separation of one thing to another, from another. It would be, if that laws of force were this simple, it would be nothing. It would be just another way of writing the same thing. But the laws of force are so complicated that it turns out that the fields have a reality almost independent of the objects which make them. One can do something like shake a charge and produce an effect, a field, and then stop moving the charge anymore, and the field keeps track of all the past. Because the interaction between two particles is not instantaneous, you have to have some way to remember what happened before. If the force on this depends upon where a charge was yesterday, which it does, then you need a machinery to keep track of what's been going on, to keep track of yesterday, and that's the character of the field. So when the forces get more complicated, the field becomes more and more real, and this becomes less and less of an artificial separation. I would like to illustrate two fundamental laws of the field. Well, the way we analyze things is to say, first, that we need two kinds of laws now. The first kind of law is the response to a field. And that is the equations of motion. For example, the law of response to a field is that MA, the force, is equal to the mass times the gravitational field. Or if there's an additional charge on the thing, it's the charge times the electric field. That's the response to a field. The second part of the analysis of the nature in these situations is the determination of the field, the laws which determine the field, the production of the field, in other words. These are called the field equations, sometimes called the field equations. And I'll write down, they're complicated, we have to learn about them in due time. But we're going to write down a few things about it. First, the most remarkable of them all, and which is true exactly, and which you can easily understand, is that the electric field, total electric field produced by a number of sources, is the sum of the electric field produced by the first source, the second source, and so on. In other words, if I have a whole lot of things making fields, and if all by itself one of them would make this field, and another would make that field, and so on, then I merely add the vectors together to get the total field. Of course, you know that that's the case for gravity. We've talked about that. We simply added together the forces, and of course, all I'm doing is dividing by the common mass or charge. This is just as true of gravitational field. That is, that the actual field produced on an object is the sum. If there are a lot of charges around, then the total field is the sum for all the charges located at various positions I. Of the charge number I, times this dopey constant of history, divided by the square of the distance to the point I from the place where you're trying to find the field. Here's where you want the field at the point P, and here's the position I. And then this is the distance from here to here to the ith particle. Actually, to get the vectors right, it's directed in the direction of I, and there's the final formula. So that this principle, that is the sum of the forces from each source, is true even when the law is here is more complicated because of the motion. It's an absolutely guaranteed law as far as we know today, and it's called the principle of superposition of fields. There are apparent violations, but when they're analyzed more carefully, it always turns out that you missed noticing that there were certain charges moving around somewhere. In other words, when it doesn't add up right, it usually turns out that you missed some of the sources. This is exact as far as we know today. Now, in discussing forces, I want to discuss another kind of force with which you're undoubtedly familiar, called magnetic force. And it's analyzed in terms of a field, too. Although I will not give at the present time the correct law of force between charges moving anyhow, one relative to the other, because it's too complicated. In fact, the whole idea of a field is to separate this problem. I will give you one aspect of it, and that is to give you the complete law of the forces if the fields are known. And it turns out as follows, that the force on a charged object depends upon its motion. When it's standing still at a given place, there's some force, and it's proportional to the charge, and the coefficient we call the electric field. But when it moves, the force is different. And the correction, or change, where's the correction? I mean, the new piece of the force turns out to be only dependent on the velocity, and first linearly in the velocity, and it's exact as far as we know, that electrical forces have the following character. The force in the x direction is given by the charge, time, a certain quantity, which we call the electric field in the x direction, plus something that depends on the velocity in this complicated manner. The y component of velocity times the z component of something. You need three new numbers to get the coefficient, bx, by, and bz. And the three laws for the three directions is this. Later we learn a little bit more about vector analysis. We'll see that this is okay in the form of vectors, but I can write it in the form of vector analysis, but now I can't. And the third one is that the z component is equal to the charge times the electric field in the z direction plus vzx by minus vy bx, which is a rather complicated thing, but it's an exact expression for the motion of a charge under given circumstances. And I would like to show you this with this experiment here, which I hope it works. I don't know. Yeah. What we have to explain the experiment is a tube in which there's a discharge back here, which makes electrons which run through the tube from here to here and hit the screen over at this point. Now we find the force on the electrons by observing whether the electron beam is deflected by seeing whether this spot moves. The first thing we'll do is we'll put electrons on one of the plates or on the other and take some away from the other. Then because charges repel, according to this law, the electrical force law, why, you'll see the thing will deflect. So the first experiment will be to turn a switch back and forth and to put the electrons here or here and see that the beam is deflected up and down. That's just a check on this, which you already know because you can comb your hair and pick up paper and this and that. But I first show that. And then next thing I show is the effect of a magnet on the electrons to show that when there's a magnetic field present, the forces are different. So let me get this thing working. First, I get the discharge. Then I find over here a switch to turn out the lights. I don't see the beam. Huh? It's not very strong. Something is the matter. Let me change some signs around. Let me flip that switch. Can I have some little bit of light? Let's try that. Oh, that's better. We got it now. All right, I go in front of here. You take care of this end, and I'll take care of it. Here's the battery, and it's connected to the pair of plates. The pair of plates, however, are horizontal, other than the drawing, vertical. And when I switch this back and forth, the beam will go back and forth. That's the first experiment. You see it jumps back and forth. Okay? That's easy enough. But the interesting one is the magnetism. So we take here a magnet, which generates a field, and I'll describe it first incorrectly, and you'll see what happens. So we have the lights out with a little bit of light so they can see what I'm doing, that light that you turned off in the back. Okay, you can still see the spot. Now you see it appears that the magnet repels the spot because the spot goes up when I put the magnet there. But if that was what the case, if I turn the magnet around without changing it, you'd think it would still repel, but it attracts. You see, it goes up toward the magnet, right? When I'm down here, it goes up again. So it's not that the magnet repels the beam. It's more complicated. If the magnet attracts, and if I simply turn it around, it repels. It's quite a different characteristic. And to understand this peculiar thing, we have the new kind of combination of forces. I'll illustrate it this way. That across this magnet, from one end to the other, we have what we call a magnetic field going this way. When the electron beam goes through it so, the force is not in the direction of the field, and it's not in the direction of the velocity. It's at right angles to both, as you can demonstrate by studying this thing. If, for instance, the only direction of the magnetic field was z, and the only direction of the velocity were y, then the only term left would be this, and it would say the force is in the x direction. So when I take my magnetic field this way, and when I turn the magnet that way, I'm not changing the magnetic field. So the deflection is always the same. And that's why this law is a rather strange one, and that's the law of magnetism. Now, in the next few minutes, I didn't leave myself quite enough time, and it's an interesting subject. Well, I'll do the best I can. The next kind of force I want to discuss is what might be called a pseudo-force, and I'll explain the idea. We have already discussed the relationship between two people with different coordinate systems, one which we call Joe and the other one Mo. I don't remember which is which. But let's suppose that the positions is measured by Joe or X and by Mo or X prime. And then the laws are as follows, that X is equal to X prime plus A, where A is a displacement of Mo relative to Joe, Y equal Y prime, and so on, something discussed earlier. I say it very quickly because I didn't leave myself enough time. Now, if we suppose that the laws of motion are correct for Joe, how will they look for Mo? We get the following. First, that the x dt is equal to the x prime dt. Excuse me, for technical reasons, will you let me call this S this time? There's no running. Because A is for acceleration, that's all. Plus ds dt. Now, last time we took the case S was a constant, and we found that made no difference, and ultimately, therefore, the laws of physics were the same in both systems. But another case that we can take is that S is a constant times a time, a uniform velocity in a straight line. Then this is not constant, but it's U. This is not zero, but it's U, a constant. So the second derivative of X with respect to T is still the same as the second derivative of X prime with respect to T, because the derivative of a constant is zero. That proves that law that we were using in another lecture, that if something moves at a uniform velocity in a straight line, the laws of physics will look the same for it as when it's standing still. That's the Galilean transformation. But the interesting case I want to discuss now is the case when S is still more complicated, perhaps, for instance, a uniform acceleration, so that this would be AT. Then this term here would be A. Or if the acceleration is not uniform, then it's an acceleration anyway, but a function of time. That would mean that although the laws of Newton laws of force looked at from the point of view of Joe would look like this, the laws of force that looked upon by Mo would look like this. Because of the difference here, there'd be another term, MA. And he would discover that he has to correct his forces by an extra thing in order to get Newton's laws to work. In other words, here's an effective force, origin unknown, mysterious new force. The reason, of course, is he's got the wrong coordinate system. And other examples are systems that are rotating. To illustrate this force, I show you the following experiment. It's very simple force, of course. If an object is accelerating horizontally this way with an acceleration, then there will be an effective gravity, of course, on an object, but there'll also be this effective acceleration, the component of this new force in this direction. The result is, if I get the signs right, you get the signs right when I haven't got time right now. The net force is this way, and so if it's a bottle, a glass of water, the surface will be at an angle. So all I want to show is that when this thing is accelerating, the surface is at an angle. First, I'll accelerate it at the beginning of the motion by hand, and then that time the angle will be this way. Then after I let go of it, it's decelerating because of the friction force, and then the angle will be the other way. And so I'll try to show that. Of course, if I make it too irregular, it'll start to slop around. I ought to try to keep the A as smooth as possible. See, it stayed up like that as it was slowing down. So that's an example of a pseudo force. Other examples of pseudo force are what you would call centrifugal force. If you're in a rotating coordinate system, that is, if you're rotating in a box, you'll find mysterious forces throwing things out to the outside, which are not accounted for by any known origin of force. They are merely due to the fact that you haven't got Newton's coordinate system, the simplest coordinate system. You'll notice a very important feature of the pseudo force. The pseudo forces are always proportional to the masses. So is gravity. The possibility, of course, exists that, after all, gravity is a pseudo force. Isn't it possible that the gravitation is just due to the fact that we don't have the right coordinate system? After all, the equations were supposed, if we have, we can always get a force proportional to the acceleration, proportional to the mass, if we imagine that the thing is accelerating. For instance, if we're in an elevator, in a box, rather, which is standing still on the Earth, we find a force that holds the guy on the floor. Let me have 2 minutes, okay? If the thing is standing still, with a certain force proportional to the mass. But if there were no Earth at all, if there were no Earth at all, and the box were here, we would float in space, if it were standing still. But if there were no Earth at all, and someone were yanking this forward with an acceleration g, then the people in the box analyzing the physics would find a pseudo force which would pull them to the floor, which would be just like gravity. Einstein's famous hypothesis is that accelerations give an imitation of gravitation, that the forces from acceleration, the pseudo forces, cannot be distinguished from a mixture with gravity. You can't tell how much is gravity and how much is pseudo force. Then he went on still further and proposed that all gravitation was in fact a pseudo force. And if you just give me a minute, I'll try to explain how, because it's crazy. It's all right to have the gravity be a pseudo. I'm held down because we're all accelerating up. But how about the guys in China on the other side? They're accelerating too. In order to make everything a pseudo force, he realized that he could do it only if the geometry of the world were much more complicated, so that we could all be accelerating away from each other in a funny way. It's not to be, the things that I'm explaining now are all qualitative, and you won't get the correct picture exactly from what I say, but only the general idea. In fact, the following illustration of how it could be, of how gravitation could be the result of pseudo forces, is purely geometrical and does not represent the real situation, but is only illustrative. Suppose that we all lived in two dimensions. We thought we were on a plane, but we're really on the surface of a sphere. And suppose that the law that when we shot something along and there were no forces on it, well, where would it go? It'd go in a straight line. But it has to remain on the surface of a sphere. And the shortest distance on a sphere is a great circle. So it goes along the great circle. And shoot another object in another direction, it also goes along the great circle. Thinking we're on the plane, we expect that those two things will continue to separate from one another linearly or something with a time. But a careful observation will show that if they go far enough, they come closer together again, as though they were attracting each other. But they're not attracting each other. It's just something weird with the geometry. As I said, this particular illustration is not the correct way in which the geometry is weird. But it illustrates that if we screw up the geometry sufficiently, it is possible that all the gravitation is related in a way to pseudo-forces. And that's the general idea of the Einsteinian theory of gravitation. That's about all you have time for. That was the, if I pushed it too hard, it was to stop it from. What? Well, when they need a stronger magnet, I don't know, for this or that. I was trying it on here, but it works very well. You can hold it way down here. But it's too heavy to handle, then this was easier.
You mentioned this is a centrifuge, and then in numerical analysis, what happens? Centrifuge is speeding up, and the angle of the Earth's field. The graphs that come out are quite weird.
The what?
The graphs that came out.
Oh, yeah, sure, because it doesn't know any difference than acceleration. Where? That's the way it combines, that's the law. It's very interesting. You see, I didn't get all the apparatus here to make the demonstration, but if I another way to make a magnetic field is with a coil. Then you can understand it. When the electrons in the coil are going around this way, it induces the electrons to go up this way. Now, when we decide that when electrons are going around this way, the magnetic field is that way, that's an arbitrary definition. It involves always a right-hand rule. And so in what's happening in here is really that the electrons are all spinning this way and this piece of iron, and this way and the other piece, both spinning this way. Around this way, they spin. And then when we put this up here, they're spinning this way, that makes the electrons bend up. And the magnetic field is a very peculiar kind of a vector. When a thing is spinning this way, it's represented by a vector that way. And it involves a right-hand rule. It's an arbitrary idea. We'll have to learn about it when we have cross products. But if you want to prove something, that this is either right or wrong, make the following. Assume that assume that the velocities transform. You know the formula that we had, cosine theta vx and so on. And that the b's also transform, same way. Show that these funny combinations do transform like the xyz components of a vector. Then you'll know at least that that law is legitimate.
But why would it be possible to just change the sign?
Because in the definition of a magnetic field, there's another one of those idiot things, is what I'm trying to say. In defining which way is the plus magnetic field, from the currents which make it.
The definition of the positive magnetic field.
That's right. There's two definitions in there. There's the positive sign for the magnetic field. If you know a little, you must have in high school learned about magnetic field. There are these damn funny rules with the right hand. Now, if you made it with the left hand, the magnetic field would change its sign, and this thing would change its sign here too. It has to do with the definition of the sign of the magnetic field, which has already been made arbitrary further back. This magnetic field is a new kind of a vector. It's not an ordinary, like a displacement vector. It's a peculiar kind of a vector which would change its sign if we change from right-handed to left-hand scheme. And this combination changes its sign once more when you change from right to left. And so in this form, you don't understand it. But if you had another law that told how the magnetic field is produced by something and put them together, then you'd understand that your signs would stay all right. It's rather complicated. It's a very good question. But it's really quite strange at first to see the thing pushed up. And then you take it over here and it's still pushed up.
Has there been shown whether antiparticles have positive negative mass?
Yeah, they have positive mass.
Sure.
Yes.
I just wondered.
Yes.
Has it been shown experimentally?
Well, by a large number of indirect arguments,
yeah.
No one has ever weighed enough positive mass. You don't mean positive charge, you mean positrons or antiparticles.
Yeah.
No one has weighed them directly, but there are a lot of theoretical arguments, you see, which are enormously precise. It turns out that, for instance, in a nucleus, in quantum mechanical effects, there's a certain probability of finding, a very small probability, but some probability of finding antiparticles in a nucleus, for example. If the moment that they were antiparticles, they weighed the wrong amount, then the weight of a nucleus would not be proportional to its inertia, to its mass. But the mass of a nucleus and its inertia weight have been checked to one part in ten, not the, yes, for a nucleus, it's checked to one part in 10 to the eighth. And if you estimate what that would mean, it's just impossible that the antiparticles have the wrong weight. There's also a much more subtle, but much more accurate test, which shows that the two have the same mass enormously close.
The reason I ask is if they did have negative mass, it could ruin Einstein's.
That's right. That's right. It would. That's another argument, because that hypothesis gives good agreement with experiment. You see, of course, what you say is right, right. You don't mean negative mass exactly, because negative mass would mean the opposite force when you accelerated them too. That they can't have, because that's against conservation of energy. What you mean is the opposite sign for weights.
Right.
The gravity is the other way. Right. And so it couldn't be imitated by this. For instance, if we had in this box a positron and electron, and it was just floating, it would be okay. If it were yanked, obviously both go down. I mean, if I yanked the box, the two of them go down. But if it were gravity, and this were the opposite way, then the one would float and the other one would sink, and the gravity would not be the same as yanking the box, and that's Einstein's hypothesis would be false. But there are indirect experimental checks beside the fact that the Einstein hypothesis agrees with other experiments. It all fits together, and it's not at all likely that the antiparticles go up. Very unlikely.
Is the Einsteinian hypothesis the only one which is in agreement with relativity, or are there other ones which...
You don't mean in agreement with experiment, you mean, or...?
With, this is the only interpretation of...
Of gravity?
Of gravity under the relativistic system.
Not the only interpretation, no. It turns out that for any set of laws, if you're sufficiently ingenious and have the equations in front of you, you can make another interpretation of the things. I mean, I could either say this is a pseudo-force or it's not a pseudo-force. Anyway. But I can take the equations of Einstein, give them a different interpretation, have the same laws. That's true. But if you ask, are there any other points of view from which different laws would come, then there have been suggested from time to time other things with different laws of gravitation which either disagree with experiment or the laws have enough arbitrary constants in them. They're not defined well enough so that when you go to make the tests, you adjust these constants so it fits. In other words, it doesn't predict the things that Einstein's laws predicted. Either because it doesn't predict anything, because it's not definite enough, or it predicts the wrong thing. So that's why we think that Einstein's law is so far so good. But the interpretations can always be altered.
Is this, from what I read in that book, I got the impression that Einstein is proposing that the natural straight line of space is going to be such that what we interpret as a force acting as a
Yes. That's what I tried to explain with this. Yeah, the natural straight line on a sphere, the only thing that's nearly straight is to go around on the great circle. But the great circles, with the two things would look like they were attracting each other. It's not so simple as this in the real four-dimensional world, because it involves both space and time. But that's roughly the idea. That's the idea. He has to have our space and time twisted in such a way that the planet going around the sun is going in the nearest thing to a straight line.
Missed it.
Damn it. Didn't have enough time.
To get to...
Yeah.
No, just about two sentences.
What did you miss?
Well, first... Well, just that the attempt to get other forces this way has failed. That's the unified field theory. And a few little, you know, calming down at the end.
Yeah, right. That's too bad at that.
It's always...
Right
I talked too long at the beginning.
I think that was it.
I did. I talked longer than I thought.
And,
yeah.
About 5 minutes left there.
That's right. It would have been good. I just talked too long.
So we're going to have to clean up all those dimensions in the transcription because... 4 pi epsilon and everything. I'm not sure whether I gave him epsilon naught or 4 pi epsilon naught.
So they're
1 over that. 4.8 times 10 to the minus 10 squared is
You all set?